A public information meeting. We are glad you have joined us tonight. For any professionals or members of the public that are here tonight, we have free packets with more information about A, which is available now, available at our front literature table. I'll just read the anonymity statement. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction, not promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio and films. Thus, we respectfully ask that AA speakers and AA members not be photographed, videotaped or identified by full name on audio tapes and in published or broadcast reports of our meetings, including those reports on new media technologies such as the internet. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our efforts to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. The format of this information session is that we will have a healthcare professional who will share her professional opinion and experience about working with alcoholics and AA. Then we will have two AA members share their experience about recovering from alcoholism through the program of AA, as well as an Al-Anon member share their experience. Please help me to welcome our first speaker for the evening, Dr. Nicola Sheeran. She is a clinical psychologist who specialises in the field of addiction and has worked with alcoholics for many years.
Wow, if the opening ceremony is anything to go by, you guys are going to have a very fun weekend. That is awesome. Well done. So I'd like to start by thanking Aussie Pa for inviting me to speak tonight. Wonderful. And I really do hope you guys have a great gathering. I was kind of hoping there'd be more health professionals here that we could persuade and really, you know, tell them about the benefits. But, I'm going to be probably preaching to the converted tonight. But that's okay. So as I was introduced, I am a clinical psychologist, and one of my main areas of interest clinically was around working with people who had substance use issues or addictions. Sorry, what's that? But I also have personal experience with addiction in that my brother is an alcoholic, currently practicing, but has at periods of time really embraced the AA traditions and meetings, and they've helped him at times. My grandmother was an alcoholic, and also my uncle was an alcoholic who unfortunately decided that he could no longer stay on this earth and decided to kill himself. So I have had family experience as well as my professional experience in this area. And so when I was really thinking about what I wanted to talk about tonight, I really was trying to draw on not so much my personal experiences, but certainly what I've observed about what I think is really great and how it works therapeutically, but also what my clients have really shared with me about their experiences in AA as well. So back when I was doing my training, actually, they came up with a really great training program that hadn't been done, and that was looking at people, dual diagnoses between mental health issues, so depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, or any of those sort of mental health issues, as well as substance use or addictions. And I got put through a special training program, which I'm seriously thankful I got to do. And as part of that, I got to do a placement at The Haven. So many of you may be familiar with this through Auscare, one of the residential rehabs. And I got to meet and work with Wayne, whom I'm pretty sure many of you will actually know. And again, that was an absolutely fantastic introduction for me into getting to know AA and the role that that would work and how it integrates in with what I might do with an individual or with a family. And so after I did my placement there, actually, they asked me to stay on, and I started running small groups there, and I also started working one-on-one with some of the guys in the houses, and then I sort of did some stuff at other places like Gillies and a few other places around on the traps, and so I was running skills-based groups as well as doing any individual support. And I've continued to do that, so some of the guys will still give me a call up and say, hey, can I come and see you again, and we'll work through things as well. So since then, I've also been working in private practice, and I was at a GP surgery, so, you know, a lot of people walking in the door would also have problems with substances, alcohol, all sorts of things that they might want to change. And I also see family members. So family members are, who are really, really struggling with how do they support their loved ones who might be having troubles as well. And so I guess what I'll do now is just share some of those things that I really started to notice. You know, this is going to surprise no one, but alcohol is a really pervasive part of Australian culture. Yeah. Understating, yeah? Cues, triggers, it's all around us. Messages about drinking are all around us in our media, everywhere. And those social forces are often so implicit, you know, a lot of people won't even notice them. And for me, when people who either need to or want to live their lives without alcohol, they find it really hard to manage the constancy of being exposed to that. And I think one of the things that I love about AA is how it really serves that vital role in teaching and showing people how to live their lives differently, creates that network of support, and really helps them to sustain change. So one of the things I really like is that learning from, but with each other as well, how to deal with these constant things that might be going on around us. Again, I think as alcohol takes a hold of us, we can spend more and more times of our lives engaged in activities around that and with people as well, where alcohol's that central part. And it means that when we decide to make that change, we may need to find new activities and friends. And I think the fellowship of AA is so central to helping in that process. I've seen many people who will make that decision to stop drinking, and then they experience the loneliness. I know that's come up already tonight, but also the boredom of what do I do? And for me, it's feelings like that that will then even trigger relapse again. So I see the role of regular meetings as vital for so many people who actually make that decision. And again, I've got so many guys who will just come to me and say, I know I've got to go this often, and I know that I've got to do this to really help me through this journey. I also really love and have heard so much about the role modelling of people who come along and the mentoring that goes on. And often, you know, I see when people hit that rock bottom place that they decide what they're doing is no longer working for them, they get that sense of hopelessness. And it's at the front, so, you know, hope is such a big part, I think, of what I see as that fundamental role that AA gives, that gift of actually seeing other people have been through this process and can do it. And I'm guessing so many of you are in the room here tonight that are actually able to pass that hope on. And I know a lot of you, I don't actually know the gentleman that ran in, but it sounds like he's been on a bit of a mission doing just that. Yeah, so another thing I think is really, really important is helping people not to forget. We know that memories deteriorate with time, and sometimes that's a good thing. I hear from childbirth that that is our one such experience that we might not want to actually remember. And I'm pretty sure you could probably think of some other memories in your lives you really want to forget. However, there's also for us a tendency when we start to forget that we really can go, was it that bad? Was it really that bad? And I think the problem is for so many people who get to that point of coming to see me or coming to see somebody, it really is that bad. Yeah, they really want to make changes. And so I see AA as doing that really vital role as well of just, you know, not in your face, but just gently saying, yeah, guess what, it was that bad too, you know. And again, reminding why people decided to stop drinking, why they are on the journey and the new experiences that they're doing, so why they wanted to change. And so far, I haven't even talked about what I think are the therapeutic parts of AA. This is just kind of, I think, the support part of what AA does. And, the way that people start to self-reflect and they come to understand themselves and they find meaning and the understandings that lead to long-term change and the steps that are outlined there as people go through that process. And they do it in a way that allows people to not feel alone. And they do it in a way where they can confront some of the shame and guilt head on by hearing it from others who may have had similar or even worse experiences and being able to work through some of those unresolved issues that might have been contributing to their alcohol use. And for many people, it's coping. It's how do we cope? And I think that's obviously where I will come in as well. Funnily enough, a few years back, I actually sat down and, I don't know, have you guys heard of CBT? Cognitive behaviour therapy. It's a, you know, the biggest therapy that everyone does. And actually, sorry. Oh, sorry, no, it's the best therapy that everyone does. Sorry. What I did, actually, was I mapped out, and someone had posted this thing about what AA does and the change components of it and CBT, and they completely overlapped. And I was like, wow, yeah. I know, double thumbs up. It was really cool to actually sit and go, yeah, there's so much similarity between what, you know, psychologists or other health professionals will sit and say, you know, that they do in the room, but it happens exactly the same here in a different way, in a probably better supported way, I would say. You know, and that's not to undermine the value of therapy. Obviously, you know, it's what I do, so, you know, yay. And I do believe in it too. But also what I've noticed is that people sometimes do need a little bit more, and actually, especially if there is depression, especially if there is really severe anxiety, which can often come out a lot when you do stop drinking, yeah? You start to notice it more, and a lot of times it had been masked before. So, that's where ICI step in, but I would never do it alone. And part of my sales pitch, I'm going to get to now, is that that they will actually... we know how hard it is to change behaviour. We know how it is to maintain and actually to take that first step. And we know that AA is the place you can go that for that first step, for that non-judgmental first step in. It's a complex issue. It's multifaceted, right? That we need multifaceted approaches, I think, as well, to actually treating it. And you guys probably know it, not any one thing works for everyone, right? So I think as well, it's also acknowledging that. But for me, if the GPs were here, I'd be saying, look, get them going along, get them getting that foot in the door, get them seeing that it's possible. And then we can support from within that and see what else might need to be worked on, or need to what other level of support might need as well. But for me, it fulfills so many different roles that they really are complementary. And so, yeah, that was my sales pitch. So, okay. So as I said, no right approach for every one person. I do think you want to be linking in, depending on what's going on, with psychologists or psychiatrists or social workers or whatever. But for me, if they're coming to me first, the first question I ask them is, have you ever been to AA? And if they haven't, you know, it might be about increasing willingness. And I've had a lot of clients who've come along, and again, that's what sustains them. They might pop in and see me for stuff but that's their bread and butter. So it's a really important part of the journey, and everyone tells me they get so much from attending. And I've also, as I said, had a lot of people who've been concerned about loved ones, and I think the level of support at things like Al-Anon and things like that, a second to none, of finding out other people who have been through similar journeys. But that was all I really had to say to you tonight, because they were the thoughts that came to me as I was preparing. But I believe there'll be question and answers, and so if anyone has any questions. But I really just sincerely, again, want to say thank you for having me here tonight, and I hope you have a wonderful conference, convention, over the weekend. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nicola. Our next speaker is an AA member. Could you please welcome Elise?
Hi, my name's Elise. I'm an alcoholic. Try not to mess with the mic. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about my story, what it was like for me, what happened and what my life is like now, and how AA has helped me recover from the disease of alcoholism. So I started drinking when I was about 13, 14, and I found alcohol to be the great release, basically, the release of from fears, from worry, from the pain that I felt inside since I was a young child. I remember being suicidal from a very young age, and alcohol took that away. Alcohol gave me an opportunity to interact with other people. That was the first time I drank. I actually could... I'm very distracted easily. Alcohol gave me... took away my insecurities, basically, where I could talk to people, I could interact, I felt like I could be a part of the party, kind of be a part of the crowd. I never knew how to be be with anybody, you know? I didn't know how to have friends. I didn't know how to interact. And, you know, once I took, the first time I got drunk, I just remember, I want to do this every day. I want to do this more. I don't ever want to stop doing this. And, you know, my life started to center around getting alcohol and other substances are a part of my story as well. And, you know, that was just basically my teenage years was just, where can I get the alcohol? Because I can't function now without that in my life. I don't know how to live life on life's terms, but if I have alcohol, I don't care anymore. I don't care about all the stuff that's going on in my mind. My mind kind of just stops the crazy. Pretty quickly I was in and out of hospitals for alcohol poisoning, for suicide attempts. That was just like a few years in when I was 15, 16. I went to a treatment center when I was 17, and that's where I was introduced to AA. It was a 12-step based program, and I didn't get it right away. You know, I stayed sober for a long time, but I didn't do anything about the program, and I just held on for dear life. And eventually I got in enough emotional pain and enough insanity that I went back to alcohol because as an alcoholic, I have a mental obsession. AA tells me I have a mental obsession around alcohol and that my mind will trick me into thinking that alcohol is safe to drink, even though last night, I couldn't stop drinking. I got myself in all this trouble, all this mess, the shame, the guilt, the remorse, the pain. I woke up and I'll never do this again, but I keep drinking because of a physical craving and a mental obsession. And eventually, my mind convinced me that I wasn't an alcoholic, that it was all crap, that AA was just trying to hold me down. And I drank again and immediately kicked off the physical craving where I want more and more and more in my body. I can never get enough alcohol. My mental obsession was going crazy, telling me every day that I could drink safely. And my life quickly spun out of control. I was tried to commit suicide several times and isolated from my family. I had no friends. And I was at this point in my life where I knew what was happening was not good. And I knew alcohol was bad for me, but I couldn't stop drinking. And I finally got to a place where I wanted, and you know, the depths of my soul, to stop drinking. But I couldn't. I had no tools. There was nothing in me that could how I could stop drinking. I was 12-stepped, as they say, where another alcoholic sat down and told me their story with AA and how they recovered from alcoholism. And something within that gave me hope that I could stop drinking. Something in her story sparked something where I thought, you sound way worse than I do, and you got sober, so maybe it'll work for me. And I asked her, you know, what do I need to do? What do I need to do? I got to a point where I wanted what she had. I wanted to be happy. I wanted to be free of this. I came back to AA and immediately started working the 12 steps of our program outlined in the big book. And what happened for me through that process was nothing short of a miracle, to be honest. It's quite profound that I don't think about alcohol. The mental obsession has been removed from me. I haven't had a drink since August 6, 2013. And it's not of my own doing. Like, I'm not sober since then because of me. Because if I'm doing this, I'm drinking. It's because of AA, it's because of my higher power, and because I have these tools to connect with a power greater than myself. That's what fellowship gives me, that's what the steps give me. And my life today is beautiful. It's really beautiful. Because the obsession of alcohol has been removed from me, I'm free to to go anywhere and to do anything that I want to do. And I have a wonderful fellowship here. I have the opportunity to give back to others. The process of one alcoholic to another to me is quite sacred because that's what keeps me sober. People giving to me, but also I'm now able to give to others this gift of recovery. And it's the number one most important thing in my life, recovery and helping other alcoholics. It's what gives me the ability to do everything in my outside AA life. I'm in uni, I'm about to graduate, I live in the most amazing country in the world, and I have great people in my life, and it's all thanks to AA, the 12 Steps, and all of you. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Elise. Our next speaker is an Al-Anon member. Can you please welcome Geeta?
Hi, my name's Geeta. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land on which we meet this weekend and to thank the Aussie Park Committee for all the work to bring us here. I think it's going to be a great weekend. Nicola, I'm going to speak mainly to you, I think, tonight. Because I have found over the years, and I have had three different therapists since being in Al-Anon, and only two out of those three understand Al-Anon. So for me tonight, I'm going to tell you a bit about my story and what Al-Anon's done for me and why I see a therapist as well. So I was born into a very strict Afrikaans family. You guys talk about Australia being a big drinking culture, so is South Africa, particularly the Afrikaans side of it. You know, the things that I never learned how to do growing up were things like I never learned how to feel anything, how to process my emotions because I was not allowed to. And it wasn't an unwritten thing, it wasn't unsaid, it was actually verbalised that you do not cry, you do not show weakness, and you don't cry over things. You do not challenge anybody at all, especially inside the family. So secrets were massive in our family. You know, I'll tell you a couple of stories. You know, when I was tiny, tiny as in five, I remember we had the first litter of kittens. And I dropped the one little kitten. It didn't even have its eyes open, so you can tell how tiny it was. I dropped it and it died, obviously. I was at home alone with my sister and I could not cry because a few weeks before that I had a hiding from my father. That wasn't the issue because we used to get them all the time for discipline. But I don't know what I did. It must have been something pretty serious because I got a hiding from both my mother and my father. But my father that night said to me, I'm going to keep hitting you until you stop crying. So that was quite clear that we don't do emotions in our family. And you don't cry, you don't show weakness. The only thing I want to hear about in this family is, what are you doing today to be successful? And success was defined as, how are you going to make this family look good? So you know, and we moved around an awful lot. Never allowed to keep relationships with friends that we left. I started school a year later, so I turned 7 in grade 1. I turned 16 in grade 12. So I skipped grades. I went to 10 different schools, but I was never allowed to keep relationships. My parents stopped me from writing to my friends as we left schools. It was hell, but there were also some good things too because I learnt to work really hard. I figured that's what life was all about. I thought I knew how to do life until I was probably about 40, and then I realised I had no damn clue at all because I'm not a funny speaker, by the way, so I'm not going to be telling any jokes, but I thought the only way to succeed in life was to work your butt off because that was the culture I grew up in, that was the family I grew up in. And so that's what I did. I worked very hard at school and did very well. I worked very hard at uni and did very well. And then I started working. Did the same thing, and so I succeeded very much, and yet I didn't understand why I felt I couldn't do life, why I couldn't do friendships, and why everybody else around me that I worked with, because that was the only kind of, you know, social thing that I ever saw in my life, why everybody else seemed to be having a much better time than I did. I had no clue. No clue at all. And of course, I was never going to speak to my family about these things because you don't talk about this stuff at home. You just don't. And then I started remembering a few little things. You know, I remember hearing the Serenity Prayer when I was about 5, and I'm going, why is that? And little pieces started coming together for me. Because, you know, I always thought I knew what an alcoholic was. No, and I didn't think they were the drunk in the park. I thought an alcoholic was that you had to drink every day. That's what I thought. Anyway, knowing all of that sort of stuff, knowing that I was primed to be an income earner, primed for the fact that I couldn't do emotions, had no clue, had no tools how to do it. I also then met somebody who I thought was pretty cool. Didn't know for a long, long time that he was an alcoholic because he didn't drink every day. But, you know, then things started, the wheels started falling off in many, many ways. Work wasn't doing it for me anymore. Pushing through every single day wasn't doing it for me anymore. And I was getting terrified because I didn't know what the hell was going on with me. Around that time, my husband, who since became my husband, we weren't married at the time, we didn't rush into stuff. You know, we'd been together for 25 years before we got married. So, you know, can't rush into things. But that's, I guess, that's an Al-Anonic and an alcoholic getting together. But for 3 years, and I had a senior role in the state government. For 3 years, he was lying on the floor. I'd go to work, he was in depression, he was suicidal. And I had tried everything up until this point. The classic Al-Anonic thing. I'll try and fix him, I'll give him books to read, I'll suggest things. None of it worked because I did not know what I was dealing with. None of it worked. And I was so petrified because the only thing I knew how to do on this earth at that time was work. So I worked longer and longer and longer hours. And then I became conscious one day that the reason I was doing that was because I was terrified when I got home, I would have to call the ambulance to pick up the body. And then I'm, you know, and as codependent as I was at that stage, and he was too, I'm going, I can't do life without him, but I don't know how to deal with this. I've got no clue. And I was in emotional and mental panic, and I didn't know what to do. I had no clue. I didn't even know, and this is the sad thing, I didn't even know that Al-Anon existed. I knew about AA. Everybody knows about AA, and most people do. I knew about AA, but he had gone to do a program run by somebody that he knew from many, many years ago, and I went, oh, God, here we go. Another thing is this is not going to do it either. I'd lost faith that anything that he tried was ever going to work. But anyway, as it turned out, I started noticing that the depression was lifting. The physical ailments, which were mainly psychosomatic at that stage, were lifting. And I thought, oh, okay, this is cool. But I didn't get comfortable for 1 minute because I'd been on this roller coaster ride for a long time, watching it go up and down and up and down. And I'm going, I can't do it anymore. I just don't have the emotional reserves to do this anymore. And then he comes home one day and says, oh, the woman who was running the program asked him whether he was an alcoholic. And I went, oh, what, really? I said nothing. Thank God I said nothing. It was one time in my life, because normally I say way too much. So one time in my life, I shut up. And I went, oh, yeah, well, you know, we'll go along for the ride. It's exactly what I thought, honestly. I didn't believe for a minute that it was going to have any impact whatsoever. Still working as a permanent public servant in a senior role in a senior government department. But about 15 months in, I looked back over the previous 15 months and I thought to myself, my God, he's changing. We are not having the violent fights that we used to have. Because, you know, when you're married to an alcoholic, you get dragged into these fights. And no matter what I tried, whether I shut up, whether I walked out of the room, I couldn't extricate myself from those things. I had no tools, but I was trying as best as I could. I had no tools and I'd go. So I'd go downstairs and stay down there for about an hour and go, maybe now I can go back upstairs. No way. It would start again. So that's what I mean. I had no tools, no way of knowing how to deal with any of this. And, of course, in my mind, it's all his fault. It's all his fault because if he just sort his own shit out, I would be okay. Not realising, like I said, that I had no tools to do life other than work. But anyway, 15 months in, I'm starting to notice changes in him and I'm going, oh, my God, I'm going to get... This is what... And this is how my mind works. My mind automatically goes to fear, automatically goes to... It's your fault. You know, you need to sort some shit out. So I'm watching him change and grow and become a better person and not fighting with me so much, and so therefore I don't fight with him as much and all that sort of stuff. And I got scared because I thought, if he's getting better through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, what have I got? I've got nothing. All I have is my work. And I got scared. But it did prompt me to ask the question, can you show me those 12 steps? And he showed me those 12 steps and I read them. I didn't study them. I read them and I went, my God, what a wonderful way to live. Seriously, I got that. It had flashed. I got the concept. Didn't understand for 1 minute the work that was involved in doing them. But I looked at that and thought to myself, how do I get to do these 12 steps? As luck would have it, or maybe as God would have it. The Gold Coast weekend was coming up, and that's when it was still a long weekend in May. And my husband said to me, why don't we go down for that? And I went, cool, can I go to some AA meetings and just sit in and listen? Yeah, yeah, you can go into those. Most of the AA meetings in Brisbane are open meetings anyway. And I went, oh, great. That Friday night meeting was a turning point in my life. That was over 8 years ago. That meeting was an old-timers AA meeting. And probably about 70% of the people who spoke that night were men. They were men who had been sober for 30-plus years. And I listened to them speak, and I relaxed because I thought, oh, God, my husband is in the absolute right place. So that was a start. And then I went, well, okay, if there's hope for him, what about me? And I'd heard about this Al-Anon thing, and I thought, okay, I'll go and have a look. But to my husband's credit, he never pushed me to go, because if he had done, I wouldn't have gone. I'm, you know, being South African, you don't do as you're told. I went into that Al-Anon meeting on that Saturday morning, and it was packed. It was a small room down at the Albert Waterways Hall, and it was probably 80% women, which didn't bode well for me, I have to say, because I've always struggled with women, because I don't have a good relationship with my mother, so, you know. And I went, oh, no, God, really? But I walked into the room, and I thought I remembered the steps pretty well. So I read the 12 steps, and I went, oh, my God, they're the same 12 steps. As it turns out, they pretty well are. There's only one word that is different, and that is in step 12. Obviously, we don't help alcoholics. We help other people who are afflicted by the problems of alcoholism. But I got some comfort that morning. I stayed. I listened. I even got to share my story. And I thought, OK, when we go back to Brisbane after this weekend, I'm going to go to every single Al-Anon meeting I can possibly go to, and I will work this program. Now, that might sound like a simple thing, but it wasn't. Because I work, and most Al-Anon meetings in Brisbane are set up for people who don't work, so basically I had to drive all over the city to get to Al-Anon meetings every night of the week. But I'm so very pleased that I did, because I got to meet an awful lot of people and to understand that Al-Anon is no easier than AA. I found myself a sponsor within the first few months of going to my first meeting, and I started working the steps. Now, yeah, I got through the steps, I worked through them, but I have to say, there is something that we talk about in Al-Anon is peeling the layers of the onion. And that image sits with me almost every single day, because I do that every single day. All I did was take off that easy little layer that was there to be taken off. And I went, yep, I sort of get steps. Yeah, I've done step 4, 5, 6, 7. Yes, I think I've surrendered. Yeah, I found a higher power. I didn't quite get all the concepts. Probably 4 years later, I started stepping back. I do not recommend it to Al-Anon members. I really don't. It's just, you know, you guys in AA talk about what happens when you start walking away from your program. The same thing can happen to an Al-Anon member, because it happened to me. I got suicidal. I lost hope in life because I wasn't practicing my program on a daily basis. And then finally, we came back to Brisbane after a failed attempt trying to live in Cairns. But anyway, that aside, I found a new sponsor, I changed home groups, and I have worked those steps like I never worked them ever before. They became a part of my life, they became a part of me, and the things that I learned were things like, every single day I have to look at the things that I am helpless over, not just alcoholism but my mind, and how quick it is and how easy it is for me to take my will back and go, oh, it's okay, I've got this, God, I don't need help. I don't need your help in Al-Anon. I don't need anybody's help. It's such a default for me still. The other thing that I learnt from my current sponsor is that all the blame that I laid at my parents' feet about how they treated me and how they brought me up, yes, whilst that's true, I can't blame them anymore because it's inside me. That's why I go to a therapist, because all of the emotional stuff, I've had to learn how to process emotions. For the first time in, oh God, it would be 50 years, I cried for that little kitten, and that only happened a few months ago. And it just came out, with the floodgates just opened up, and I finally let it go. I look back on that now without any emotion. I look back on that now going, that was just an incident in my life. That's what Al-Anon has given me, is the ability to continue to look at myself and continually to want to peel more and more layers off until I find out who I am, how I can be of service to each one of you, whether you be an alcoholic or an Al-Anonic, it doesn't matter to me. And the better part about that is to spread that out into everybody's lives that I touch on a daily basis. Now, I don't do that perfectly. You might, but I don't. But I try. And that's all I can ever do, is the best that I can every single day. But I can't just do Al-Anon. I have to have a therapist help me deal with the emotional stuff. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Geeta. Okay, our final speaker for tonight is an AA member. Please welcome Roy.
Thanks, thank you. Yeah, I'm Roy, I'm an alcoholic. What a way to be welcome to country. So I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting on country, pay my respects to all elders, both past and present, and equally as important, we mustn't forget and should never forget our brothers and sisters who have gone before us. And Unc's not here now, but I would have extended that appreciation of being welcome to this country, because that's very important spiritually for me as an individual to be welcome to this beautiful country. And to the committee members, Morag, Ange and all the rest of you, thank you very much for your service. God bless you. You know, I think in one of the traditions it talks about we need leaders in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're leaders, trusted servants. You know, and without leaders in Alcoholics Anonymous, we wouldn't be having functions like this. And what comes with leadership is responsibility. And sometimes you've got to make the hard calls, and it's not easy. And the planning process, thank you very much. God bless you. Yeah, for me, what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like now, I come from a big family, small community. Mum had 8 kids, reared up on a mission and reserve, and we lived from pension day to pension day, and it was a struggle. My mum was an alcoholic, like the previous speaker. You know, it was right through the family, it was rife. And I firmly believe, for me, I share my experience, strength and hope, monkey see, monkey do. Yeah, it was around. We were very poor. But none of that made me an alcoholic. None of it. There were contributing factors there. Many contributing factors that I can lay blame to. But really, none of that stuff made me an alcoholic. I had my first drink at the age of 15. And Nettie says on the Central Coast, I have one story, but it has many chapters. I had my first drink at the age of 15. 2 things I remember about that first drink. There was plenty of vomit. There was spew everywhere. And the second thing I remember was just laying on my back and everything was just spinning around. And the more it'd spin, the more I'd vomit. I had it up my nose and in my hair and in my ears, and it made me violently ill. And I was sick as a mongrel dog the next day. I can remember it. I'll never forget my first hangover. I couldn't move off the lounge. I couldn't lift my head up. But I truly believe that, honestly believe deep down in my soul, that before I had that first drink, well, I know before I had that first drink, I had low self-esteem. I had no confidence. I felt less than. I thought other people were better than me, and I just didn't fit in. I wasn't good enough for that group, and I wasn't good enough for that group. and there was no centre of the road for this alcoholic. I drank right through my teenage years. By the way, after I got over that first hangover, I could not wait to back up and do it again. Even though it made me vomit everywhere, I was sick as anything, I couldn't wait. Because them feelings of feeling less than, not good enough, not fitting in, they all went out the window. I felt a part of. But I went to the other end of the spectrum. I was a shy person with low self-esteem that couldn't look you in the eyes. Put a can of Jim Beam or Coke or something in me. I'm the best sort in the house. I'm God's gift to women. I'm Michael Jackson going for the 80s. And at the end of the night, I'm Mike Tyson. This is only Friday night. So really, I didn't know who I was. But I loved it. I've got to be... It's an honest program. I loved the piss. I had some really good times on the drink. But I don't remember standing in the mirror on a Friday night, done up to the nines, pocket full of money, ready to go out and say, Roy, okay, tonight you're going to go out and you're going to try to crack on your best mate's missus. You're going to try to king eat someone. You're going to piss yourself. You're going to get locked up. You're going to wake up with ink all over your fingers and you don't know what you've done. I don't remember saying that in front of the mirror. I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to go out tonight, I'm going to pick the best sword up in the house. We're going to rock this baby when I get home and it's just going to be the best time. 9 times out of 10, that didn't happen for this alcoholic. If it did, guess where I'd be? I wouldn't be in this room. Absolutely. Yeah. So this alcoholic, I drank right from my teenage years, like I said. 2 days after I turned 18, I woke up in Bathurst jail. And I said, oh my God, how did I get here? And I blame the community and I blame the police and I blame the magistrate and I blamed everybody else. I even blame Captain Cook for bringing it here in 1788. And Dan Murphy, I don't even know Dan Murphy. I said, if he wasn't selling it so cheap, I wouldn't be drinking. Excuses, excuses, excuses. Not accepting responsibility for my own actions. So cut a long story short, I've got all these kids all over the place to different women. Centrelink was my major sponsor for 10 years. So I had a major sponsor on the drink. Police stations, magistrates, courthouses, hospitalisations, thieving cars, breaking into people's houses, king-hitting people, robbing people, rorting people. None of that missed me. But none of that made me an alcoholic. And I'll keep repeating that for a reason. And we'll unpack that very shortly. So I'm going nowhere fast. In the end, I was in the park drinking. We used to call them park rangers. The old gummies in the park. I was in the park drinking flagons of McWilliams and Moselle out of a Vegemite jar with the park rangers. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm looking across the street and my mates who I went to school with and everything, they walk up the street hand in hand with their wives and their kids and they jump in their motor cars and they drive off. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? So I was to continue to drink I was to continue to go crazy, and it was just madness, dead set madness. What happened was I was in Sydney on a geographical. I now know they're geographicals, and I was running. I didn't know what I was running from, and I ended up in Sydney. And this angel from Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason why I say he was an angel, because if you're doing God's work, you are an angel. And he come up to me, and he knew I was an alcoholic. And he said, "Roy, why don't you come to an AA meeting?" And block your ears, lady, and I don't know whether I... But these are exact words. I said, "What the fuck is an AA meeting?" I had no idea. This was 15, we're talking 15, 16 years ago. I said, what the F is an AA meeting? He said, "Mate, look, it's where people go if they're having challenges with their alcohol and some other things that aren't working in life." And he caught me coming off a real bad bender, and I said, "Mate, listen, I'll take you up on that offer. Just to shut you up, I'll go and have a look." I went to my first AA meeting. I don't know whether it was Lidcombe, Stratfield, Ashfield. It was in Sydney there somewhere. All I can remember about that first meeting is I walked in, I sat down, I looked up, and the surrender prayer jumped straight out at me. The word God. And I'm thinking, oh, here we go. Christian turnout. Bible in one hand, gun in the other one. You're going to force it down my throat. Because I walked in there with prejudices, you see. And the book talks about that. About having an open mind. I had a closed mind. I went back out and got drunk shortly after that meeting. I didn't get sober from my first meeting. And I walked back in the rooms on the Central Coast on the 31st of August 2002. And God willing. You know, come next month, it's be almost 14 years. It's 13 years and 11 months or whatever, you know. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a blessing, you know. And Elise, fantastic. You've done so well. And I want to pinch what you said, Elise. I cannot stand here and take responsibility or credit for what's happening in my life today. I come in here, I was told to stay away from the first drink and come to plenty of meetings. Very good advice. I did that for a long, long time. But there was something missing. Something missing. I was going crazy. I haven't had a drink and I was coming to plenty of meetings. I'm talking 6-7 meetings a week. And things did... Look, don't get me wrong, things did improve. Materially. Physically. But there was something missing. And I seen it in other people. They had a glow about them. And they oozed this spirituality. And I said to someone, "I want what you got." They said, "Brother, you got to do what I did." No, okay. I ended up in a psychiatric hospital on the northern beaches. I think I was about 8 years sober. I haven't had a drink, but I was putting $2,000. $1,500, $1,800 in a poker machine. I swapped the witch for the bitch. And I thought they could help me. I'll go there. I since found out that it cost my private insurance, health insurance, $13,000. $13,000. I never had that type of money in my life. $13,000 for a 3-week intensive support program. And it did help. You know, it talks about going outside for professional help, and it did help. I'm not going to criticise that. It helped tremendously, but it didn't stop me. It didn't stop me from going to the club and putting that money in the poker machines, and because, see, if I was told if I don't treat my alcoholism with them steps, my alcoholism will treat me in other ways. Whether it's food, sex, sloth, gambling, whatever the case may be. So by this point, I'm ready to take myself out, or someone else. I was a powder dry drunk, crazy, mental. And mind you, I share my experience, strength, and hope. Now people will agree with what I'm saying or disagree. That's fine. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous, one thing it's given me is an opinion. And I hear a lot of opinions in AA. And you can question my opinions. And I can question your opinions. But guess what? You cannot question my experiences. And I can't question your experiences because that's what you've been through. I haven't walked in your shoes, nor have you walked in my shoes. And I got to a point where I needed that help. And God, I said God scared me out of the rooms when I first come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Jeez, I'll tell you what. Without the grace of a loving God and my understanding, I certainly wouldn't be standing here today. Everything I've accumulated in the past 13 and a half years, nearly 14 years, like Elise said, I owe it all to a loving God and my understanding. Something that scared me out of the rooms. So God put this lady in my path, you see. And I asked her, and I said, would you be my sponsor? And she said, Roy, I want to ask you one question only. She said, I don't need the answer now. You call me tomorrow morning. Have a think about it. I said, what is it? She said, are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober? And I said, I can answer that now. She said, no, you won't. You call me tomorrow. So I went home and I'm tossed and I'm turning. I'm thinking to myself, if I say yes, I know it's going to be work and I don't like work. And if I say no, it'll be just continue down that path where I'm ready to check out or do something silly or, more importantly, just go and pick up a drink. So I rang her back and the next morning at 6 o'clock and she said, what the F are you ringing me this hour in the morning? I said, yeah, I'm willing to go to any lengths. She said, okay. She said, come down to my place. I live on the Central Coast. She lives down the other side of Picton. It's possibly maybe a 2-hour drive at best, maybe 2.5 hours. And I said, what? You want me to drive all that way? She said, you said you were willing to go to any length. See, she had a sense of humour. And she's hard. She was very hard. But it's what I needed. She told me the truth, unconditional love. She told me, warts and all. That's why she made sure that if I committed to this, to do that book work, because there's a difference between the fellowship and the program of recovery. Fellowship, program of recovery is outlined in the first 164 pages of the big book. So it gets down to her place, she looks me in the eyes, the very first question she says to me, I'm eager, I'm keen, I'm ready to go, I'm sick as a... up here, I'm just mental. She looked me in the eyes, she said, okay, we'll start, eh? I said, yeah, well, I've been sitting here for 5 minutes waiting. She looked me in the eyes and she said, Roy, just one question I need clarified first. She said, how do you know you're an alcoholic? I looked her and went, what type of question is that? I said, I drink a lot of piss. She said, so? I said, I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, so? I said, well, I don't know. And she said, Roy, that's a very good starting point. Because when you don't know, maybe there's a big chance you could learn something. Because your problem's been in the past is that you thought you know. And you think you know. And you're full of ego. My job is to unpack that and basically kick the shit out of you. In a polite way. So she opens the book and we go through the forward to the new edition, and the first thing she pointed out was that it talks about it says that we recovered. The first 100 talk about being recovered. Recovered from what? Recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Then it goes on to say, precisely. It shows you precisely how they recovered. If you follow the directions. See, I'm not very good at following directions. You want to piss an alcoholic off? Reject him or tell him what to do. You're going to get a fight. So we're there, and she takes me to that, and she shows me that, and then she talks about, you know, our triangle and the circle, and unity, service, and recovery. You know, and the circle around it. If I'm practicing all three sides of the triangle, mentally, physically, spiritually, I become whole. Very important stuff. I don't do this perfect. I'd be lying if I said I did. The book talks about we've got a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I've got to do this every day. It's like going to work, I've got to clock in. I've got a bundy on, then I've got a bundy off. And by the way, it's the best paying job I've had in my life. So we go to the doctor's opinion. And she said, we're not going to worry about your opinion. We're not going to worry about my opinion. Let's have a look at the doctor's opinion, shall we? Okay then, let's do it. So we're reading through the doctor's opinion, and then I suddenly realise where my disease is. Because before, I said thieving cars and jails and broken relationships and robbing people and rorting people. See, none of that made me an alcoholic. I thought it did, because I was a bad person. But now we started to unpack what really made me an alcoholic. The facts. So we looked at the doctor's opinion. Then the doctor starts to unpack it. It talks about having a mental obsession. I obsess, obsess, obsess until I give into that obsession. Once I give into that obsession, I have that first drink. And the doctor describes it as a phenomenal craving. When I have that first drink, it goes all over my body. I get the sense of ease and comfort that comes with the first drink, and then bang, the phenomenal craving kicks in. But the good doctor also talks about where my disease is. It centres in my mind. I thought it was in the pub, the club, or the bottle shop. It's in my mind. I went, oh, okay. So it's not the ex-wife, it's not the missus, it's not the kids, it's... Oh, righto. Then it goes on to unpack it a little bit further. And it talks about we have no mental defence against the first drink. Willpower won't keep me sober. See, in the spiritual experiences, I think it's on page 567, it talks about contempt prior to investigation. And I'm not that smart, but that's what happened to me at my first meeting. Contempt prior to investigation. I thought I knew all about it when I knew absolutely nothing. So the first step, we start talking about the first step, is broken down into three parts. The mental obsession, the physical cravings, and the unmanageability. 52 pages are dedicated to the first and second step alone. And if I don't get the first step right, I'm wasting my time with the Mother 11. And I had to see the madness in my first step before I could take the second step. It talks about insanity. And we all know what the definition of insanity is. It's going out doing the same old thing and expecting a different result. I was doing that time after time after time. Until I could see that in my first step, she wouldn't let me go near my second step. And I remember going and after a blackout, ink all over my fingers, missing teeth, and I said, that's it, no more, it's over, I'm not drinking no more, I've had enough, I promise you, I swear on things grave, Nan's grave, grandfather's grave, blah, 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 blah. 2 weeks later, not even a week and a half later, I'm waking up in Dubbo, in the park, wet pants, alcoholic diarrhea, and I'm thinking, how did that happen? How did that happen? I drank against my own will. That's how powerful this disease is. So we're looking at the second step. And then we come to the big one, the third step. See, I'm not very good at making decisions. I'll go and ask 5 people, and if it's wrong, I'll blame one of them 5 people. But if it's right, I'll take credit for it. The best decision. The best decision I've ever made in my entire life. Probably the only decision. I made a decision to hand my life and my will over to a loving God of my understanding. Not your understanding, my understanding. I get down on my hands and knees with my sponsor. Wow. Now I'm starting to access the power. And I'm worried about the fourth and fifth and sixth. And she said, what are you worrying about them for? I said, oh, no. She said, hang on, stop. After the third step, my friend, you've got nothing to do with it. It's a loving God that's going to walk you through the rest of them. But it's going to cost you. Them steps are so important, as the previous speaker said. You know, don't do it perfect. Like I said, what it's like today for me, my life today, whew, where do you start? I was at a graduation ceremony 3 months ago. My daughter got up and graduated with a lawyer's degree. I got a lawyer in the family. 18 months ago, I'm sitting at another graduation ceremony. My son gets up and graduates with a podiatry degree. He's a foot doctor. I'm pinching myself. What has this got to do with Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, I'll tell you what, it's got a lot to do with Alcoholics Anonymous because they're the principles that I've passed on through the process of this program. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't like talking about it much, but I'm going to talk about it tonight. and Maurie's up the back there and the team's smiling up. We were at a convention last year. I got this email on the 1st of April. I think it was last year or the year before. Anyways, I thought it was an April Fool's joke. And they said, Roy, we've been trying to track you down for some time now. It come from New York City, the International Service Centre. We've been trying to track you down. We'd like you to come over to the International Convention in Atlanta, Georgia, and come and speak, 1st of April. And I wrote back to him and I said, if this is a sick effort and April Fool's joke, it's not funny. In red writing, you know. And the lady wrote back to me and said, you answer your phone, I'm calling you at blah, blah, this is no joke. And I went, wow. She rang me back and we started talking. And she said, Roy, how many people have you spoken in front of? I said, oh, big crowd. Maybe 60, 70, 80 or something. And it's big for, you know, on the Central Coast. And she said, oh, okay. We want you to come over and speak at the International Convention. She said, there's only going to be about 67,000. And I nearly fell over. I said, what? Are you serious? She said, I'm very serious. I went, okay, let me think about it. No, all right, let's do it. And I knew that God's got a plan for me. You see, God wouldn't send me up here, or God wouldn't send me to Atlanta, Georgia, to fail. And like I said, I can't take credit for that. I was carrying God's message. I was here. I was a vessel for a loving God of my understanding. And I went over there, and we had this, I think this guy from Philadelphia or somewhere, and a lady from New York City, and they went first, and then I had to go last. So I'm sitting there for 40 minutes, just shitting myself. But what came in was the principles of program, four-step prayer. God, remove my fears and direct my attention to what you would have me be, not do. God, remove my fears, direct my attention to what you would have me be, not do. And I said that over and over and over. Please, God, let the right words come out and the wrong words stay in. And then I said it over, and then I jumped up there and it was just a blur. 20 minutes just went like that. There's a clock down in front of me and I'm looking, and I looked down and it had 5 minutes to go. And I'm thinking, jeez, how quick did that go? The moral to the story is that I never in my wildest dreams thought that things like that could happen for this alcoholic. See, the book talks about inspiration and aspirations. But it comes at a price. This young girl in the, down in Seven Hills, not Seven Hills, in Sydney, one night at Balker Mills, she was only early in recovery. She said, you could read a recipe book and die of starvation, and you can read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and die of alcoholism if you don't put the action in. See, I'm lazy, I'm slothful, I want other people to do it for me. When it's too hard, I can look at your defects of character. You might want to work on this and that, yeah, you're a real bitch, you know. But look at mine, no, we won't go there. How grateful am I today? And I flew business class, by the way. I have to throw that in. From a lad that come from drinking flagons and Moselle, sitting up in business class with Qantas pyjamas on. How good's that? I said, are these complimentary? They said, sure are, Mr. RC. I said, well, give me 5 pairs, I've got a big mob. They said, what size? I said, extra large. And I said, oh, well, come on. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I've seen I was sitting up the back there near on, and I seen the committee come up, and that's the fellowship. That's what people crave for. Now, having the confidence to get up and regardless of what people think. See, fear told me that I wasn't good enough to be here. And mate told me in America, he said, when fear knocks on your door, let faith answer it. Because there's no room for fear if you've got faith. And I love this. I love the program. I love the fellowship. Someone said, oh, do you have bad days? And I said, oh, well, I like to think that I have character building days. I said, this guy is crazy. How much time have I got? 10 minutes. And so now, as a result of being an advocate for a loving God and my understanding it, and Alcoholics Anonymous, hence why I dress when I'm representing AA. This place is spiritual, it's sacred, it's given me everything I've got today. Why wouldn't I come and dress appropriate? Why wouldn't I show that I'm an upstanding citizen of my community because I'm representing Alcoholics Anonymous? The only time when I was on the grog that I wore these suits was that I was looking at a good lagging. I'd wear them to court. Or a funeral. You know, I've got a wife today who I'm responsible for and responsible to. And I don't do it perfect. Relationships are, you know, they're hard. You know, I used to pack up and just want to run away from them. But today, and relax, Jack on the Central Coast, I think he's got 50-something years, I'd be... Roy, you got to front up, mate. You got to front up. It's about fronting up. Regardless of what the outcome, you got to front up. And fear used to... Oh, I was crippled with fear. False evidence appearing real. And when I heard that, I went, wow. I thought you guys were that articulate. I was thinking, oh, you can't be alcoholic. Yeah. I was thinking, you're too smart. You know, this is the College of Knowledge right here. You know, I've got a meeting on the Central Coast. We've started on a Saturday morning. Please drop in if you're ever there on a Saturday morning at 11 o'clock at Watanabe. You know, we started a beginner's meeting, a Koori beginner's meeting. It's a spirituality, Koori beginners. You know, and the young fellas that come in there, you know, young Koori fellas that are at the rehab. And I'll never forget this. It was so powerful. It's just something that sticks in my brain. This black fellow was there, and he couldn't even look me in the eyes. He wouldn't even look. It was that low down. He couldn't lift his head up to look in the eyes. And I called him, and I was in the chair, and I called him. I said, "Brother, would you like to have a share?" And he jumped up, and he stood there. And he stood there for about 5 minutes, and he didn't say a word. It was the most profound, powerfulest thing I've seen in a long, long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because sometimes it's not about what you say. Sometimes it's more about what you don't say. And see, a lot of our people can't read and write. So I could be someone's big book. Because the shame factor that's in with our people. And that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, because we're all equal. At the Glen, they have, down on the Central Coast, we have they have the Glen. They have a fire in the middle, and everybody sits in a circle. And the circle is a very powerful symbol, because once you're in that circle, You become equal. No one's better than you. No one's less than you. That's why they have that circle, the sharing circle. Very, very powerful. Because even in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was restless, irritable and discontented for a long, long time. But page 133 talks about being happy, joyous and free. Man, I love that. I love being happy, joyous and free. I know what it's like to... I use this analogy. When I first come into Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like a plane trip, a flight, if you're going to go somewhere. You've got a destination, and obviously there's a process you have to get there. I know what it's like to go economy to get to that destination. It's a little bit uncomfortable. It's not a lot of room to move. And there's got to be another way. But I'll eventually get there. And that's what I done in AA when I first came in here. It was really uncomfortable, actually. But then I found a sponsor who showed me unconditional love and told me the truth and walked me through the 12 steps. And I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And then I ended up in business class. And I'm thinking, wow, I can lay back, I can put the pyjamas on, I can flick through the movies, I can sleep all the way, I can have as much food as I want, all complimentary. And I'll get there in comfort. And I know which way I'd rather do it. I hear a lot of opinions in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, don't rush the steps, you're going too quick. I think Bill Wilson was in hospital, if I can recall, when he may have done his fourth and fifth step or something. That's not rushing, and I don't know what is. And I love this fellowship. I really do. It's given me everything I've got today. This disease killed my mum. I buried her when she was 57. She had 8 kids, 5 girls and 3 boys. In the end, she couldn't walk from here to the little sign there. From a big, strong woman to someone that couldn't walk there, you know. And I was 10 months sober when I buried her, if there was any point throughout my drinking that I was going to have a drink, it was at that point. But again, I had an older sober member from Alcoholics Anonymous who nurtured me through that grieving process, didn't tell me what to do, give me a couple of options. You can go and drink with the mob if you want, or you can bury the woman with a bit of dignity and pride that she deserves. And thank God I took the latter. I'm so looking forward to the weekend. Because this place is the best show in town. And if they only knew, we'd be having meetings at Brisbane, what is it, Suncorp Stadium. If they only knew. You see, we're the lucky ones. Well, I'm one of the lucky ones. Because not a lot of people make it. See, fear won't keep me sober. God will. I was at a meeting one day, and I'm going to close very shortly. And I don't consider myself to be a poet. I'm an artist. I'm a bullshit artist, my brother said. I'm there, and it's like I'm it was death by PowerPoint. This guy's up there on the PowerPoint, and it was like the pen just started writing itself, and all of a sudden I looked on the page and there was this poem sitting there. And I truly believe that it was God-given. And God gave me this poem. And he gave me this poem for one reason. And that's to share it with as many people as I possibly can. By the way, that's what my sponsor said to me. Roy, I'm going to walk you through these steps for one reason only. That you go out and work with as many people as you can, alcoholics, and take them through the book. And I try to do that today. Not sometimes it's not perfect, but I try to do it. And I'm getting back to that death by PowerPoint. I'm looking, and I've had this poem in front of me. I went, wow, where did that come from? It's God given. And it goes like this. It's titled, "If You Have a Dream, You Have a Vision." If you have a dream and a vision, make it real, make it a mission. You'll have your ups and your downs, but don't let it knock you around. If you believe it's possible, then fight and tussle to allow it to be colossal. You may have to be bold and mean if you believe in this dream. You may have fear whispering in your ear, but tell it to go away because you're not wanted here. For I found my place in this earth. It is my role to inspire you to challenge your self-worth. So go on your way and move towards your vision, and don't let anyone stop you from achieving your mission. For it is God who will be our final judge, for it is he who holds no grudge. So take the first step, as hard as it may be. It starts today with no more delays, for delays and excuses are for those that are leaners, but that does not include you, because yous are all dreamers. Thank you and God bless.
Thank you very much, Roy. Okay, could we thank all of our speakers? All right, what a great start to the weekend it's been. At this time, I would like to open the floor to any questions for any of our speakers. I've got a couple of microphones here to walk through the audience. If you have a question you'd like to ask Nicola, Elise, Geeta, or Roy, please just put your hand up and I'll come around and give you the microphone.
Thank you, great question. It was, would have been 8 months, 9 months for the actual process, because I was sent away to actually do some book work and then we'd catch up and then, yeah, so it was a really thorough process.
And just to add to that then, what about your comprehension then? How long did that actually take? And are you still comprehending those 12 steps?
Big pardon? The
comprehension of the 12 steps, how long did that actually take from you putting them into your life and actually going through them formally, but then having a grasp and being able to utilise them as tools and then development with them?
The way I went through with my sponsor, it wasn't just a matter of reading the information. There was a lot of writing involved. And for me, I don't know about other people, but I retain information better if I write it down. So I was taught to write it down so it sticks there. And then if you start to do that for a little while, all of a sudden that information becomes ingrained in, in, in your mind, and we all know where our disease centres. It's up here in my mind. So, yeah, it's a matter of doing that, writing that information down, and just retaining it.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Question or comment for Nicola. First, thank you very much for your presentation here tonight. How do you feel is the best way to get more of the professional people to first attend these things and implement the program that you said that you can implement with other people?
Thanks, Angie. Great question. I teach first-year university students, and it kind of reminds me of the same thing of how do we get them to come to class, because I don't actually have an answer, but I have no idea. And I think, from my point of view, I wasn't meaning to say, oh, I thought it was all going to be doctors here, but I think it's that you guys, as part of your service, is about passing on that message, and I think all of us can take whatever opportunities we've got as well. So that's what I do. I will take that opportunity. I train clinical psychologists, and I'm actually doing the drug and alcohol unit. So, I think for me, it's grassroots and starting to go up and continuing to invite and continuing to encourage and, filtering it through. I think just like everyone here has been touched by whoever it was that made that first contact, I think that'll be the same kind of process. But I think also if anyone is going to see a psychologist or any kind of health professional, really suss them out. I mean, you guys probably do anyway, I hope, but ask questions and be quiz them, and do just be able to say to them, what's your understanding? Have you ever worked? Do you understand what AA is about or in addiction and how do you work? And really check that you're going to be a good match, because otherwise you're throwing money away on that sort of stuff. Yeah. So, thanks.
Yeah, Kim Alcoholic. I've got another question for you.
It's a shame that Uncle's here, we could tap dance together.
Being a teacher, is there anything in the curriculum or whatever?
It's funny, I was just asked this today, just tonight as well. No. So the short answer is no. It's really individual. How I said I went out on placement to The Haven? That's where I got educated. And because we get sent all over the place, we get educated and we're kind of wherever we are and the models that are around there. Actually, I've been working, I supervise as well, clinical, and so we'll be finding out about the GROW programs and things like that. So you kind of just accumulate knowledge over time depending on your experiences, which is part of the problem. But I think for people, when you're in, if this is the area you're interested in, I think then it's the responsibility of that particular individual to make sure they are educated about the different models. Now, as I said, I now take the drug and alcohol section, so I can assure you that this cohort as well, that's where I'll be starting, of actually going at the bigger level picture, these are what you need to be aware of, and then dropping down into some other stuff that we also need to know for working. But
is there an opportunity to put in your seminars for this?
I'm going to think about that, because I don't have much control over the curriculum, but I will be thinking about where we have room in the program for that sort of stuff.
This is another question for you. Do you think AA as an organisation is actually getting that information out enough to the professional people? Because like that, if you're not being placed where you first had experience it, how else can we as an organisation introduce it to, because we have services that already help and associate with emergency is their first recourse or even as a reference or support system referring to AA or somebody they suspect may have an alcohol problem. What else can we do as an organisation?
Yeah, geez, that's really interesting. I've got ideas running through my head, like professional bodies and how do we get partnerships going. And, you know, I'm sort of sitting there thinking at what level you've kind of got your, again, the people who are working in these areas and networking with them. For example, I also work in a lot of gay, lesbian, transgender, and I'm in the networks for that. And so I go along to the network meetings that are related to that, and they have, through community organisations, networks set up where everyone who's a health professional who works in that area goes along. I'm not aware of anything. I mean, there are, in, say, the APS and stuff, there are, alcohol and addiction groups and things like that.
Just to add to that, I mean, we can't, according to our traditions, be affiliated or even actual or applied as well, so we can't put our name to anything per se.
Yeah.
So, again, within the boundaries of our traditions,
Let me think about that. If I think I come up with anything, because we're really moving towards a model at the moment where we're doing a lot of mental health professional networking kind of things, and there's lots of movement happening around that. And so I think there's opportunities there for, I mean, all you need is one voice on in a networking panel and you start getting information shared, really. So let me think about that. If I come up with any brainwaves, I'll be sure to let Maureen know. I've solved the problem. This is how we can get everyone. Yeah. But again, you know, I think it is GPs as well. They are the first point of contact. I mean, they're the gatekeepers for just about every other mental health professional as well. And they're the ones giving that first piece of information. So.
I like that Maureen does great work in everything as well, but we also have a central service office
that
they can spread that out.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, she's just my... I have her email address, that's all. So I was like, yeah, I can contact her. Anyone else for me? Or?
Hi, everybody. I'm a member of Ballarat, and I would just like to share with you there was a movie now that's on the formation of Ballarat. It's only about 2-year-old movie, so it's not real ancient. When Love Is Not Enough, it's well as a story. Like, you know, if anyone wants to buy it from the library, it's in your system, so you don't have to buy it. But it really highlights to the extent that they went through. It's very sad as far as being with them and the family. But they've got this fellowship and they are going, it's amazing. So do all of us. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tracy. I'm a councillor based here in Greenway. So, so I'd like to pick up on the question prior to the last speaker, where it was asked, how do we reach out to professionals more? So I'd just like to give you my take on that, if I may. Basically, I got the invite by email to come along tonight. Obviously, others didn't do. I have a thirst for knowledge, and so I keep, getting information. I come into something like this. But I think as a working professional, you've got so much information that you need to accumulate into your life. You're bombarded by it, to be honest with you. You lose something that looks interesting, but you know, you put it to one side and maybe one day I'll read that. I've come along tonight, I had clients, I know a bit about AA because I have a client that went through AA and I was his counsellor and he did AA and what he achieved in his life was miraculous. So I was partly interested in coming along tonight because of that, just to see what's going on, okay? But for me, unless someone gets in my face and said, I would like to sit down with you and talk to you about this, then, you know, if you send me information or whatever, it may or may not get read. But if someone's going face to face and go, I think we've really got something here, that would be a benefit to your clients, so maybe we could work together, can I come see you in half an hour at a time, then I would be more receptive to that because, like, we've been here for an hour and a half, I've got certain information on this thing, right, okay? But from a professional point of view, I would like as much information as possible in the shortest amount of time. So that would be my comment. Thank you, Shane.
Thank you,
Pierre.
There's another, Lisa, another question down the front here. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm the public information coordinator for the Gold Coast District. I just wondered for the professionals, if we have like a talk or something, really a workshop, quite a short one, that was during like work hours, would that be better for professionals because you're actually getting paid to kind of attend something like that? Or is there a good time for us to come and talk to you?
That's going to differ, I think, from professional to professional, sorry. I don't know about you, but I think that's a great idea. And I think, you know, what you're targeting in terms of the information is really getting to the crux of, I don't know about you, but the work that goes on. So, you know, yeah, I talked about how there's all the extra benefits and stuff, but it's that therapeutic component and actually understanding that for me was a critical part of how it's similar and different to what we do in terms of individual work or whatever we might have been trained in, but understanding the program and understanding, you know, the steps and what that's actually getting people to do, you know? Yeah.
Thank you.
But yeah, work time's probably good.
Are there any more questions, guys? No? Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for your questions, and thanks for coming along tonight to the PI meeting and the opening ceremony. Please stay around for tea, coffee, and fellowship, and there's plenty of food there as well. So help yourselves. And we just also ask, if you are smoking, it's just outside the front door and along to the right there. Okay. Any other announcements? Oh, our first meeting in the morning is at 8 o'clock. Okay, it's in the, I believe it's in the second room. Also, lunch, what does that say?
Lunch tomorrow.
Lunch, soup,
$5.
Don't forget about Alateen. Alateen as well, what time's that?
11:30
for Alateen. So this will be the main room for Alcoholics Anonymous. That room right there that you enter from the foyer is going to be the Al-Anon room. And then to get into the second AA room, you just walk out the front door and it's right there. You can't miss it. It's closest to the cigarettes. So it's that's why we made it AA. Alateen is behind the registration table in a private room there. Yeah. And also, if anybody is here for the Aussie PAR group conscience from another state, that's on at lunchtime tomorrow in that Alateen room as well. Okay, if you have any questions, please ask the committee or anyone. We're happy to help you. All right, thanks for coming. All right. Anyone who would like to do the Serenity Prayer, to a God of your own understanding. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change,
courage to change the things I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference. Keep coming back.